Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I always used to dream of the past, but like they say, is today never comes. Sometimes there's a song in my brain, and I feel what my heart knows the refrain. And I guess it's just the music planning for nostalgia for nature to come.
When we recycle, that's good. When musicians recycle, well, that's a different story. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today on the show, we'll hear about the nostalgia craze that's fueling today's musical economy, and we'll take your calls. Plus, a live performance from the bluegrass trio, The Devil Makes Three. But to begin, we seem to be living in an age of re. Nearly every day, there's news of another reunion tour, a reissue album, some recycled sound. Now, nostalgia's always been a powerful force in music, but the music writer Simon Reynolds says that pop's appetite for its own past has reached a tipping point. His new book is called Retromania, and he joins us today from the studios of KPCC in Pasadena. Simon, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Nostalgia in music is certainly nothing new, and musicians, composers have always drawn from earlier materials. What's different now?
I think part of it is that there's just such, pop music, rock music, whatever you want to call it, has been going for maybe 4 or 5 decades, and it's accumulated a lot of past behind it. And it's all there in a way that where it's much more available to people through the internet, through, file sharing, YouTube. It's a lot more accessible than it was. And I feel like people are just kind of almost drowning in the past. And it's almost like it's become more fascinating than the idea of, for young musicians, the past is more fascinating than the idea of the future. They're not so, there's a sort of mystique about lost things and rediscovering, almost like an archaeological dig, that hip-hop idea of digging through the crates for obscure records. That seems to motivate a lot of musicians, younger musicians that I've interviewed.
So, far from you sounding like a cranky old man saying, it was better in my day, it seems like you're saying the exact reverse, that, people are not looking forward the way they should be.
Yeah, you could say that's based on my experiences as a member of my generation. I was born in 1963, so the 60s was a cultural presence. Even when I was a teenager, it's still something very much in the air. I lived through the post-punk era. As an adult and a journalist, I got very involved in the rave scene. So these are the sort of benchmarks of, futurism in pop that I kind of that my values are based on. But I think I'm kind of complaining that music isn't moving fast enough.
Right.
It's too comprehensible to me. It's not that it's it's not that it's this crazy new music that makes no sense and it's noise. It's more like I can see where it's coming from. I can see the reference points too easily.
And perhaps not where it's going to at this point. I want to get back to the whole idea of the tipping point and where that might actually be tipping us to. But to give folks a chance to hear what we're talking about, the first decade of the 21st century, the re-decade, featured revivals, reunions, reissues. This reenactment by Van Morrison, he played his 1968 album Astral Weeks front to back live in concert in 2009. Van Morrison singing Ballerina and the rest of his 1968 album, Astral Weeks, live at the Hollywood Bowl in 2009. We also had reunions in the past decade, among them the Pixies, who disbanded in 1993 but got back together in 2004 and have lately been touring around their classic 1989 album, Doolittle.
You never wait so long.
And in addition to the reenactments and the reunions, there have been, of course, the reissues. The popular reissue label The Numero Group released an album of songs recorded in East St. Louis in the 60s, like this track called The World is Changing. Hey,
looks like the world is changing overnight. Yes, it is now. People grooving on different things, and it's all right.
Lavelle Moore from East St. Louis in the 60s, and The World is Changing, a reissue label called The Numero Group has taken a bunch of those previously obscure recordings and made them available to everybody. Simon Reynolds, author of the book Retromania, Pop Culture's Addiction to Its Own Past. What's so bad about any of this?
Well, I think, let's start with Van Morrison. Mm-hmm. I'm one of those people who thinks Astral Weeks is like this sacred document. It's like a unimpeachable, towering masterpiece of rock. And I think the fact that there's now a record in the a CD in the world called Astral Weeks Live at the Hollywood Bowl, it's just a horrible stain on this masterpiece, you know. And the version, that version was not very good, you know. It's nowhere near as good as the original on the record. So to be honest, if I'd been living in LA when you did that, I might have just gone along just to see it. I only moved there recently, but and I can see why fans would come, and I can also see why Van Morrison would do it, you know, perhaps to reconnect with his fans and other reasons, perhaps. But
would those other reasons be financial?
Know. Well, I wouldn't want to say that, but you know, who knows? There might be a reason. I just think, you know, it's a shame that these records deserve their esteem and their sort of towering place in history, and you can see why they're iconic. I just think there's something sort of redundant about the repetition of them. There's a certain strangeness about the idea of listening to a record all the way through. Because at the time, bands were, when the
you mean listening to it all the way through in a live
in
performance.
Sequence. Yeah, that's what I mean. The other example was
The Pixies.
Pixies. Well, you know,
the
I wrote
reunion
about the Pixies
tour.
when they came out. I was, you know, a supporter of them as a journalist when I was first a journalist. And they're a great band. And you can see why they might want to. I think rock and roll is kind of cruel in the sense that, you know, we expect bands to shuffle off once they've done their great work. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to be troubled by them. And they have the whole rest of their lives to live for. And, you know, they have bills to pay and stuff. So I could see why they do it. I mean, for me personally, as an old Pixies fan, I've saw them so often in the past, I don't really want to see an older version, even though it might sound better because sound systems have improved and the group may even have got better as players. I don't know, but I just think I wouldn't want to reconsume my own past.
Although you
I'd
do
rather leave it as memories.
In the book, you do make an exception for Gang of Four.
Yeah, I never saw them at the time, so that's my excuse there. I was just really curious. And I made a mistake of seeing them twice, and the second time was at the Hard Rock Cafe, and it was just too weird to see them play where, you know, you had pictures of Jerry Garcia and Janis Joplin on the walls.
So right. Just,
but the first time, they were fantastic, you know, and it was I'd never seen them. But and the third example was Numero Group.
Yeah.
I think what they do is good. And, you know, the quality of the stuff they dig up is remarkable. I think it's a testament to just how much great sort of mostly they release black music, and it just shows how much great black music was going on in all these city-based scenes, and how strong the musical traditions were. I think though, someone who was discovering soul now would be better off listening to, you know, Curtis Mayfield and, you know, the obvious soul greats that were out, you know, released on major labels at that time before they got round to, you know, some of these obscure artists. And I noticed in the hipster world where, you know, you have all these cool reissues come out, people tend to sort of go for the most esoteric things and mm-hmm. often miss, you know, really obvious mainstream things that probably more deserving of their attention.
Now, there are so many things available to us, and, you know, from obscurities, from regional scenes to recordings that had previously been out of print for many years. Do you begin to feel an anxiety on the part of some artists that, you know, that they are kind of drowning in a sea of potential inspirations and influences?
I don't think I get a sense of anxiety from the musicians themselves. They just feel like that's the musical reality they're growing up with, which is that it's all available to them. And it's all, you know, they almost feel like the past is theirs for the reaping. But the question is, you're doing all this reaping, but what are you actually sowing for the future? You know, if you're, there's so many bands, especially in the indie scene, that in the last decade have picked up on ideas from the 80s, all different corners of the 80s, because there was a lot went on in the 80s. And I just wonder, you know, sometimes they come up with interesting twists on it. Sometimes it's a fairly empty, you know, fairly hollow pastiche, but it's not really creating new ideas, you know, for the future. To, you know, their future equivalents. What are they going to, when they go back to the noughties, you know, what are they going to find there to actually, you know, pastiche or be inspired by?
Well, what do you make of a song like, you know, LCD Sound System, the song Losing My Edge, where, you know, we hear James Murphy kind of questioning, you know, how do I deal with all of this stuff?
Well, I thought that was a brilliant song. It sort of captured, you know, it captured some of the sort of anxiety and pathos of the cool hunter, the person always seeking the new edge thing, and feeling like he couldn't, you know, he makes a reference to feeling outflanked by the internet seekers, like younger people who are even more adept at finding cooler and more esoteric things to be at. So I thought that was a hilarious sort of kind of auto-critique, like he's kind of critiquing himself and his own mentality.
So there's definitely a kind of ironic edge to the song. Losing My Edge is the name of it, from LCD Sound System.
Seekers, who can tell me? Tell me. Every member of every good group from 1962 to 1978, although we're losing
That is LCD Sound System, Losing My Edge. What do I do? How do I keep up? All the hipsters in Brooklyn and Berlin, he's saying, James Murphy's saying. You know, they're finding all this stuff before I can. We're speaking with Simon Reynolds. He's with us from the studios of KPCC in Pasadena. His new book is Retromania, Pop Culture's Addiction to Its Own Past. Soundcheck listeners, what do you think? Is pop culture addicted to its past? You got a good example for us? Or do you disagree with Simon? Tell us about something in pop music that you think is genuinely new. Give us a call either way, 212-433-WNYC. That's 433-9692. Or leave a comment on our webpage at wnyc.org/soundcheck. And Fabio is on the line quickly with us from right here in Manhattan. Fabio, what do you think? Is there really retromania going on?
Well, to be honest, modern music, from my opinion, most of it is just crap. And it's just getting to the point that it's been so watered down and really lost the emotion to the music. Like, I love listening to classic late 60s, 70s, 80s rock, because it's just in every verse and every line, there's just so much passion. And I think that a lot of younger people, I've noticed, I've tried myself to introduce them to this older music. Mm-hmm. And I'm only 26, but it's just so bad how you can't understand why is rock sound the way it does, because people like the Beatles and these great old bands like the Clash, they made music sound the way it is because that's what was good. And I always try to introduce people to that, and I think that's why so much older music is coming back, because people are more and more finding this old stuff that's just really good.
Well, that's an interesting point that brings us back to the question, Simon, that you raised very early in Retromania, which is that we have reached a tipping point. What are we being tipped into?
I think the thing that, you know, that intrigues me is whether this is just going to carry on. You know, whether you know, already people are talking about the 90s revival, and there's a lot of commemorative stuff going on to do with grunge. There are bands who are influenced by grunge. There's, in Britain, there's even bands influenced by Britpop, you know, like imitating or very closely based on Oasis. You know, so the 90s revival is on. Is it just going to punctually carry on? Are we just going to have like a noughties revival? And what would it be based around? If so much of the music of the noughties, from Lady Gaga, the top of the mainstream to all these hipster bands in Brooklyn and Berlin that LCD Sound System was making fun of, were inspired by the 80s. I mean, how in the future can you have a revival of an 80s revival? I mean, what is there going to, where is the nutrition in that? There's no musical substance, I think. At a certain point, the ideas wear thin, I think. So that's what I mean by a tipping point. I mean, things could just carry on like this, but it seems like something has to break. There has to be some new surge of, of passion and meaning and reconnection with the world. I think one of the problems is the music is music about music, and it has a very, you know, it has often the emotions, even in things I like Ariel Pink, it's often a music that is in love with some earlier phase of music, mm-hmm. and it's not so much about life or about the world, you know.
Well, you write actually several times about Ariel Pink. What is it about this retrolicious music that that you like, perhaps despite yourself?
Well, I think he's a melodic genius. I think he's a very interesting, conflicted personality. There is some emotion actually that comes from his real life and his real personality in that, and he's a sort of but a lot of it is about the way he conjures these sort of memories of golden ages of radio, where, you know, there are things in his music that make me remember the times, the blissful times when I first kind of was entranced by the radio as a 14-year-old. I was just had my ear cupped to the transistor radio trying to pick up this signal.
This is Ariel Pink and Bright Lit Blue Skies. Song is Bright Lit Blue Skies, contemporary music with lots of sounds of classic pop and rock from Ariel Pink's Haunted Graffiti. And we are speaking with Simon Reynolds, the author of Retromania, Pop Culture's Addiction to Its Own Past. We'll continue our conversation and take more of your calls in just a moment. And coming up later, a live performance from the bluegrass band with the punk attitude. They're called The Devil Makes Three. That's later.
I grew up on an older road. A pedal to the metal, always did what I told. Till I found out that my brand new clothes came secondhand from the rich kids next door. When I grew up fast, I guess I grew up mean. There's a thousand things inside my...
See, I'll leave with every piece of... Don't underestimate the things that I will do. There's a fire starting in my heart, reaching a fever pitch, and it's bringing me out the dark.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. More now with music writer Simon Reynolds on pop's appetite for its own past. And we're taking your calls at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. In the background, you're hearing one of the biggest hits of the year, Rolling in the Deep by Adele, a British singer who echoes the golden age of soul. Simon, is this sort of emblematic of a lot of what you're talking about in Retromania?
Yeah, when this record became this monster hit, I was like, oh, this is such a gift, because I'm doing these interviews and I've got something I can talk about that people will, you know, understand what I'm on about. I mean, the thing about, you know, that's just very... strong song. I can see what's a big hit. It's, mm-hmm. it's a great tune. She's a good singer. And it has that passion, actually, that the caller was complaining about. But the thing about it is, if you know, she's doing a style that's 45 years old. She, you know, her big influence is Etta James. Really, what is that's the, what she's doing is very similar to what Harry Connick Jr. did in the 90s when he came along and he was doing this sort of retro jazz thing. But he was sold as a, you know, as a nostalgia act, really.
Right.
Adele is considered a fully contemporary artist. You know, she's probably going to get Grammys and all kinds of, you know, Brit Awards in Britain. And, you know, she's considered like a representative of modern pop music, but the style is 45 years old. I mean, I never expected to get to the 21st century and to find music that was so sort of conservative, really, being the most popular music. And that's one of the things that I guess troubles me. And I can't deny, you know, my daughter is five. She loves that song, and it's a great song. But why is there this appetite for such an old-fashioned style of music?
Well, let's see what some of our listeners think. Kate is joining us from upstate New York. Kate?
Hi.
What do you think?
Well, I mean, a couple of things. So, I mean, I think that the appetite, by the way, is, you know, for nostalgia is pretty obvious to me, which is nostalgia makes us feel young. It's a youth serum of sorts, right? And music does that really, really well because you're drawing upon a memory of when you knew the songs before, if you were lucky enough to grow up during that time, right? So that's pretty powerful kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't suspect we'll ever go away from that. But I think, I mean, part of the reason that music isn't really new, although, I mean, I've been a programmer at XM and other stations for a long time and big fan of new music, but still agree totally that, I mean, we're always referencing older stuff, is that, I mean, I think younger artists now just didn't live through any of the great innovators that we lived through. And I'm, you know, fairly young. I mean, so innovators in my lifetime were Michael Jackson or Kurt Cobain, really, right?
Mm-hmm.
But at least I have that as an actual experience, which is much more powerful than going back. And I mean, you know, I only wish I could have had a Dylan during my lifetime, right? Not possible. It's not the same as living through it, as going back through the record racks. So I mean, I think that's the problem. But what's more interesting to me is that, I mean, the largest population in our culture is the boomer generation right now, right? These are the people who should be driving the music scene. And essentially, as we're saying, they are, because all
right.
This music is referencing their time.
And that seems, Simon, to be one of the kind of, I think Kate is right. You know, aren't we seeing the kind of the hegemony of the boomer generation kind of filtering down through the rest of the culture?
Possibly, but, you know, Adele is, what, 21 or something? It's her choice
yeah.
to sing that style. You know, the Fleet Foxes is a very good example. Their whole style, they've talked about this in interviews, their whole music is based around the records from their parents' record collection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no one forced them to pull out the Crosby, Stills and Nash records and Fairport Convention and the other stuff they're influenced by and base their identity around it. I can see why what the caller is talking about, which is relates to this phenomenon that LCD Sound System song is about, which is this borrowed nostalgia for the unremembered 80s. Well, you could fill any decade where 80s is borrowed nostalgia for the unremembered 60s. It's a strange nostalgia for something. It's not really nostalgia because it's not really about your own life.
Right.
It's not the ache or yearning you feel for something you've lost yourself. It's a sort of a kind of secondhand nostalgia, isn't it?
We almost need another word for it.
Yeah, because it's a different kind of pain. It's not the pain of losing something. It's the pain of perhaps feeling like you
missed out. Yeah,
were born too late. Yeah,
yeah.
Born too late feeling.
Let's see what some of our other Soundcheck listeners have to say. Joel Meyer in the control room with some of the comments. Joel.
John, our listener Mickey from Harlem writes this: I'm glad that my favorite bands can still make a living off touring. I don't go to see them much, but my daughter does. And another interesting point from our frequent commenter, Robots Need to Party. Robots writes, personally, I think retroism is where a growing music fan should start. The past is written, and for the most part, the jury's in on what was good and what was bad. It saves a new listener a lot of time for looking for what's good.
A good point. Simon, your response?
I don't think there's anything wrong with listening to old music. I mean, you should, you know, when you grow into music as a listener, I think one of the problems the present has actually is that there's such a lot of great classic music, like, you know, Astral Weeks obviously is a classic record. I mean, how many records in any given new year are going to be as good as Astral Weeks or the first album by the Smiths or, you know, Led Zeppelin 4, whatever.
Right, but if you didn't live through, you know, the 70s and didn't know Astral Weeks, wouldn't Van Morrison coming to town, playing that record front to back at the Hollywood Bowl, however much you don't like it as an idea, wouldn't it in practice be a great way to introduce a whole bunch of new people to that album?
I guess so. I'm not sure what the ticket price was, but I imagine it was rather more than actually buying the original Masterworks CD, which might be the best way of doing it. But
what about listening to Adele, hearing her in interviews reference people like Etta James, and then, you know, all these 20-somethings, the people who listen to it, well, a lot of people listen to Adele, but, you know, a fellow 22 or 23-year-old saying, oh, I wonder who this Etta James is. And then through the media, the medium of this new music discovers the old.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. And increasingly, bands, I've noticed one of the things I talk about in the book is how bands signpost influences very blatantly in their interviews. And like even, you know, Panda Bear did an album where he, it was Person Pitch, I think, where he had a whole part of the CD booklet. It was just this sort of list of names of his influences. And it was very varied. And it was like esoteric stuff, but also Duran Duran was one of them. It was like almost like his little manifesto of, I listen without prejudice to everything and I'm very open-hearted. So that seems to be the way bands operate now, is they kind of turn their fans onto stuff. But that's been going, you know, the Smiths did that. Morrissey talked about, you know, being loving Sandy Shaw and all these kind of things in the past. So it's been a common syndrome, I think.
And I think Charlie on the line with us from Montclair wants to pick up on that thread. Charlie, the idea that maybe this isn't such a new phenomenon?
First I want to say, Simon, I'm really a big fan of your work, and I'm going to go out and get the book, and I read it on the plane next week. People don't seem to remember, well, maybe the people aren't old enough, but in the 70s, I covered the scene in the 70s, and a lot of the younger bands in the 70s, mid to late 70s, were making it on remakes of songs from the 60s. The example I gave to your screener was Pat Benatar, and she broke on a song that was a hit from the Young Rascals, You Better Run. And when that came out, a lot of people, you know, a lot of the younger people at the time, I remember, never even heard of the Rascals. Mm-hmm. And it had been a huge hit in the 60s, and, you know, it went away, and, you know, it came back through a younger band. Now, the point that I'd like to make is that going back to the 40s and 50s and the 60s, you had a thing like the Brill Building, where there were people whose job it was to write hits. It wasn't the band's job or the musician's job to write the hits. You had people who just went to work and banged out these hits, got them to the record companies, and
they were professional songwriters. That's what they did.
They were professional songwriters, and they weren't, okay, I got to go out on tour, and maybe I'll write a song on the back of the bus. No, this was their 9-to-5. Yeah, you know, Ellie Greenwich, and, you know, just the list goes on and on. And the songs that they wrote that turned into the classics of the time, these were really well-crafted, pieces of pop that reflected the culture and the moods of the time. Now, I'm not saying that the bands are not doing that, but the other thing is that
let's stick with this thing, Charlie, because that's a really good point. And Simon, you know, I was thinking perhaps along similar lines earlier, which is, you know, a lot of movement has happened in music over the past 40 and 50 years. You know, we had punk and hip hop and disco and rave and the many varieties of techno. There was a lot happening in a relatively little period of time. If you look back at the 40s and the 50s and the early 60s, people growing up and listening to music then were singing a lot of the same songs that their parents and even their grandparents were singing. So popular music has gone through periods before where it seemed to kind of stay in one place.
Yeah, I think one of the sort of conclusions I draw in Retromania is the idea that it's the very fast-moving nature of pop music in its sort of what I call surge decades, which would be primarily the 60s and some of the 70s and the 90s. But generally, everything we've seen up to the recent era of pop music, they move really fast. They generated a lot of ideas and they pile up. And at a certain point, it almost becomes as tempting for new bands to draw on old styles that have still got some, you know, nutrition in. They've still got ideas that could be explored and developed. So it's almost a function of the fast-moving, super-generative periods of pop music history almost bring about these periods of relative stagnation where people kind of digest and rework ideas. So perhaps, you know, this is a phase we're going through, and something, some new machine, some new technology will come along that will push music forward again.
As has happened in the past. I mean, the piano was a major piece of technology in the early 19th century that pushed music forward. We've been speaking with Simon Reynolds. The book is called Retromania, Pop Culture's Addiction to Its Own Past, and it is full of really interesting examples of music that has very obvious roots in past music. The Black Eyed Peas in the back, this song called The Time, is clearly an update of I've Had the Time of My Life from the film Dirty Dancing from the late 80s. Simon Reynolds, pleasure speaking with you. Thanks for joining us on Soundcheck today.
Thanks for having me on the show, John.
Dirty bit. Dirty bit.
Still to come, a live performance from the bluegrass trio The Devil Makes Three. Yes, bluegrass, but don't call them retro. That's coming up next.
I don't want to take no pictures. I just want to take some shots.